So please join me in welcoming Marcus Chown.
Thank you. So is this all this answer? Great. It's fantastic to be here. It's great to see so many of you. Thanks for coming. I'm a science writer, and as a science writer, I'm constantly amazed at how much stranger science is than science fiction, how much more incredible the world is than the universe is than anything that we could possibly have invented. So tonight, I thought I would do a rundown of my top 10 bonkers things about the universe. Now, it's a very personal list, and if anyone's counting, you might find there's slightly more than 10. I got a bit over-enthusiastic. I want you to look at this image. It's a rather grainy, not very high-quality image, but it's an amazing image. It's an image of the sun taken at night. Now, you may think, at night, the sun is below the horizon. How can you possibly take a picture of the sun? Well, this is actually an image that is taken not looking up at the sky, but looking down through 8,000 miles of rock of the Earth to the sun on the other side of the Earth. And it's not taken with light, but it's taken with neutrinos. Now, neutrinos are ghostly subatomic particles which are created by the sunlight generating nuclear reactions in the core of the sun. And they flood out of the sun in prodigious numbers. There's something like 100 million going through my thumb every second. Now, neutrinos, one of their characteristics is that they are incredibly unsociable. They hardly ever interact with normal matter. They hardly ever stopped by the atoms in normal material. But of course, to actually get an image of, to actually make this image, they obviously do interact occasionally. So this image was actually taken by a neutrino detector in Japan called Super Kamiokande. There's a similar detector you probably know in Canada at Sudbury. And basically, if you want to stop a neutrino, you just need a lot of matter. So if you have enough atoms, occasionally one will stop a neutrino. So this Super Kamiokande detector is basically a giant baked bean can about 10 stories high filled with water. And very occasionally, a neutrino will go through this large mass of water and will interact with a proton in a water molecule, and the shrapnel, the subatomic shrapnel, will screech through the water, and it will make the sound equivalent of a shockwave, which we call Cherenkov light, and that light is picked up by light detectors all around the edge of the detector. So that's how this image was made. Neutrinos, because they are not stopped very much by matter, they can travel in straight lines out through the sun, because the sun is incredibly dense, yet they can travel virtually unhindered from the core of the sun to the surface. And they do that in about 2 seconds. But I want you to contrast this with light, with sunlight, which is also generated by the nuclear reactions at the center of the sun. Now, light, of course, is stopped by matter. You know, you can't see through a brick wall. And the sun is like, a million kilometers of brick wall. So the light, the photons, the particles of light which are generated at the center of the sun, unlike the neutrinos, have tremendous difficulty getting out of the sun. They never travel for more than about a centimeter before being scattered or redirected in another direction. And so they take the most incredibly tortuous path out of the sun. And instead of taking 2 seconds to get from the core of the sun to the surface, they take about 30,000 years. So my first bonkers thing about the universe is that today's sunlight is about 30,000 years old. It was made at the height of the last ice age. My next bonkers thing about the universe is that you could fit the entire human race in the volume of a sugar cube. And this is because matter is mind-bogglingly empty. You've probably all got a picture in your mind of an atom from school as a kind of miniature solar system with electrons orbiting like planets around a central nucleus like the sun. But this doesn't really give you an image of how empty atoms are. Tom Stoppard, the British playwright, came up with a fantastic image. He said that if the nucleus at the centre of an atom was like the altar at the centre of St Paul's Cathedral in London, then an electron was like a moth in the cathedral, fluttering one minute by the altar, the next by the dome. But even this doesn't actually tell you how empty atoms are. I can tell you how much empty space there is in an atom as a percentage. It's 99.999999999999999%. So you can see, if you squeezed all the empty space out of all the atoms in the whole human race, you could indeed fit the human race in the volume of a sugar cube. You may ask, well, why are atoms so empty? And the answer to that is quantum theory. Quantum theory is our very best description of the microscopic world of atoms. And it tells us that the fundamental building blocks of our universe, microscopic building blocks, atoms, electrons, photons, have a very strange dual nature. They behave both as bullet-like particles, tiny bullet-like particles, but also waves, like waves on a pond. And waves are kind of spread out things. They take up space. It turns out that the quantum waves associated with the building blocks of matter are bigger the smaller the particle in general. So the electron is the smallest particle we know of, which means it has the biggest quantum waves associated with it. So it's because electron waves need so much elbow room that atoms are so empty. Now, this thing about putting the human race in the volume of a sugar cube isn't just theoretical. There are bodies, celestial bodies, out in the universe called neutron stars. And neutron stars are the end result of supernova explosions, when a massive star gets to the end of its life, blows itself apart. Paradoxically, when that happens, when the exterior gets blown away, the interior gets implodes and makes a neutron star, which is probably something about a bit smaller than Waterloo, but the mass of the sun. And if you could go to a neutron star and dig out a chunk the size of a sugar cube, it would indeed weigh as much as the whole human race. My next bonkers thing about the universe is that if the sun were made of bananas, it wouldn't make any difference, or it wouldn't make much difference. Okay, what you need to know is, why is the sun hot? Well, the reason the sun is hot is incredibly simple. The sun has a very large amount of mass, and all that material is crushing down on the core of the sun. Gravity is crushing it down. And when you squeeze material, it gets hot, as anyone who's ever squeezed the air in a bicycle pump knows. And when you, at the kind of crushing pressures inside the sun, the temperature is about maybe 15 million degrees in the core. And at those temperatures, matter dissolves into an amorphous, anonymous state known as a plasma. And it doesn't really matter what that matter starts off as. It ends up in pretty much the same state. So the sun is about billion, billion, billion tons of mostly hydrogen gas. But if it were a billion, if you were to get a billion, billion, billion tons of microwave ovens, or a billion, billion, billion tons of bananas, and put them in one place, you would get something essentially as hot as the sun. So the principal reason the sun is hot is because of the amount of material it contains, not its composition. Its composition has an effect on how heat is bottled up inside the sun, but principally it's its mass. Now, what I've told you is why the sun is hot at this instant in time. I haven't told you why the sun stays hot, which is an entirely different question. Clearly, the sun is radiating heat into space all the time, yet it maintains the same temperature. So there is something that must be replacing the heat that the sun loses as fast as it is lost. Well, in the 19th century, people speculated on what that source was. They lived in a world, an industrial world, powered by steam, so it was obvious for them to think that the sun was a giant lump of coal. It would be the mother of all lumps of coal, more than 1 million kilometres across. So the question then was, if the sun were a large lump of coal, how long could it maintain the kind of heat output that we could see before burning out? So really all you needed to do is you needed to measure the heat produced by a chunk of coal in a grate and scale it up to the size of the sun. And when people did this calculation, the answer they came up with was that the sun could only burn for about 5,000 years if it was a chunk of coal. This was not even enough for Archbishop Usher. Archbishop Usher was a 19th century Irish bishop who famously calculated from the Bible that the earth and sun were born on, I think it was Sunday the 23rd of October, 4004 BC, at 9 a.m. in the morning. So 5,000 years wasn't even enough for him. And really, there was a lot of evidence in the 19th century that the sun was much older and the earth was much older. For instance, there was evidence from geology. I mean, there were mountains, for instance, in the Canary Islands off of Africa, where you could find, on top of a 10,000-foot-high mountain, you could find fossil sea creatures. So the inference was that at one time that mountain had been beneath the sea. And it had risen up and carried these fossils with it. But nobody sees a mountain rise in a human lifetime, so it was obvious that if this had happened, it must have taken tens of millions of years. Then there was the evidence from biology, from Darwin. Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection told us that all organisms on Earth had evolved from a common ancestor by very slow mutations. And nobody, or you rarely see a species change over a human lifetime. So again, Darwin knew that the Earth had to be hundreds of millions, if not billions of years old. And really, in the 20th century, we discovered that the Earth and the Sun are pretty much close to 5,000 million years old. That means that whatever is powering the Sun, because if it was a lump of coal, the sun would burn for 5,000 years, but the sun is apparently 5,000 million years old, so whatever is powering the sun is an energy source which is pound for pound a million times as concentrated as coal. Coal is a chemical fuel, like oil or even dynamite, so a million times more concentrated than dynamite. And in the 20th century, we discovered that source, it's nuclear energy. And what the sun is doing is it's fusing the nuclei, or cores, of hydrogen atoms, the lightest element. It's fusing those nuclei together to make helium, or nuclei of helium, which is the second lightest element. This is a multi-step process. If you imagine hydrogen as a single Lego brick, helium is four Lego bricks. But the first step in this process is the crucial one. The sticking together of two hydrogen nuclei, two Lego bricks. This is just about the most inefficient nuclear reaction that you can imagine. On average, it takes two protons, two hydrogen nuclei, about 10 billion years to find each other and stick in the sun. And it's because this reaction is so inefficient that the sun takes about 10 billion years to burn its fuel. And because of that, there's been time for the evolution of complex life like us, which has taken, you know, 3 or 4 billion years. I just want to give you some idea of how inefficient this nuclear reaction is. If you were to take your stomach and a portion of the sun's core the same shape and size as your stomach generates heat more efficiently, generates more heat. So you might think to yourself, if the sun is so inefficient at generating heat, how come it's so hot? The answer is there's just a lot of it. You know, there isn't just one chunk the size of your stomach. There are countless quadrillions all stacked together, and they together produce the heat output of the sun. My next bonkers thing about the universe is that you age more slowly on the ground floor of a building than on the top floor. And this is a consequence of Einstein's theory of gravity, which tells us that time flows more slowly in strong gravity. So if you're on the ground floor of a building, you're closer to the mass of the Earth, so you're in marginally stronger gravity, so time flows more slowly for you. It's a fantastically small effect, and you would really need the most sensitive atomic clocks to measure it. But incredibly, I think it was about 6 months ago, a team of physicists managed to show that you aged more slowly on one step of a staircase than the step above, which is only a distance of about 10 centimeters. And I think they used an atomic clock that was so accurate that it lost about a second every 3 billion years. Now, this effect, you might think it's of no consequence to you, but in fact it is, because if you have a phone or a sat-nav that uses works out your position relative to global positioning satellites, those satellites are moving in elliptic orbits around the Earth, and they come in close and they go out far away from the Earth, and the clocks on board by which your position is calculated relative to them slow and speed up according to this effect. So actually, this effect has to be compensated for in your mobile phone or a sat-nav, so it does affect your life. Now, the slowing down of time in gravity obviously is very small, but near the strongest source of gravity we can imagine, a black hole, it's actually appreciable. And if you could hover near the horizon of a black hole, time would flow so slowly for you that you could watch the entire future history of the universe flash past your eyes like a movie and fast forward. Now, do people in Canada know Doctor Who? Yes, yeah. Okay. My next bonkers thing about the universe is that time travel is not ruled out by the laws of physics. It's easy to see how time travel will work, actually, because Einstein's theory of gravity, as I just told you, tells us that time flows more slowly in strong gravity. So to build a time machine, all you need is a region where time is flowing, say, normally, like here, and another region where it's flowing more slowly, say, near a black hole. And if you imagine these two regions, I don't know, they start off on both of them on Monday. By the time it's Friday on Earth, it's only Wednesday by the black hole, because time's flowing more slowly. So if you could instantaneously go from the Earth to the black hole, you could go from Friday back to Wednesday. Is there a way that you could instantaneously go from the Earth to a black hole? Well, incredibly, Einstein's theory of gravity does permit the existence of a thing called a wormhole, which is a shortcut through space-time. So you could build... So the recipe for a time machine is basically to have the Earth, a black hole, connected by a wormhole. There are a few problems here. For a start, you've got to go and find a black hole and travel there. But wormholes are very unstable, and they snap shut in a split second. So you need to prop them open, and you need something called what we call exotic matter, which is some kind of material that has repulsive gravity to keep the mouths of the wormhole open. Then, in order to keep the wormhole open about a meter wide so you could crawl through it, you would need to turn an appreciable fraction of the mass of all the stars in our galaxy into other forms of energy. So, as I say, I'm not saying it's easy. The other thing is that you cannot actually make a wormhole from scratch. That would require changing what we call the structure or topology of space. And you can't do that within Einstein's theory of gravity. So you'd have to find a pre-existing wormhole. We think that the quantum theory views that space-time itself on a very, very small scale is kind of very foamy and full of tiny submicroscopic wormholes. So you'd have to inflate one of those to full size for to make a wormhole. But anyway, clearly there are quite a few problems in building a wormhole, or building a time machine. But the key thing is that although it's practically, it seems pretty impossible, in principle, it is possible. And this gives physicists sleepless nights. Because, as I say, this recipe for building a time machine does exist. And it opens up all kinds of nasty paradoxes. The most famous, of course, is the grandfather paradox. If you had a time machine, you could go back in time and you could kill your grandfather before your mother was born. Dull thing to do, but you could do that. And then the problem is, how did you actually go back in time? Because how could you go back in time if you weren't ever born? So that's a nasty paradox. Stephen Hawking, who I believe gave one of these lectures, famously has suggested the chronology protection conjecture, which is really just a fancy way for saying time travel is impossible. He thinks that there is some law of physics, and most physicists believe this, there is some law of physics that cuts in, that we haven't yet discovered, that makes time travel impossible. I just want to point out two differences between the time travel that is permitted by Einstein's theory of gravity and the time travel that you may be familiar with, from books like The Time Machine. H.G. Wells is The Time Machine. If you remember the movie of The Time Machine, Rod Serling, the actor, sits in a contraption of brass with lots of dials, and he pulls a lever, and he goes forwards and backwards in time. Well, you can't do that. In order to move through time, you have to move through space as well. You cannot do it by sitting on the spot. The second thing you cannot do is that you cannot go back in time to a time before you built your time machine. So if someone here builds a time machine this evening, in 2012 they can come back to this evening, but they cannot go back to 2010. So if you want to go on a dinosaur safari, you'll have to find a time machine that was abandoned on Earth 65 million years ago by extraterrestrials. Okay, my next bonkers thing about the universe is that the concept of past, present, and future, or common past, present, and future, do not exist in our fundamental description of reality. Our fundamental description of reality is Einstein's special theory of relativity, and that tells us that how we cut up our reality into past, present, and future depends entirely on how fast we're moving relative to someone else. Now, it turns out that these are kind of effects that you'd only see a difference if you were moving relative to someone else at a speed that was appreciable compared to the speed of light. And the speed of light is more than a million times faster than a passenger airliner. So really, the reason that we have, we actually all do believe that we exist in this present and we have a common past and a common future is because we live our lives in the slow lane compared to the speed of light. But why do we experience a present? That doesn't explain why we experience a present. Why do we focus on information gathered from our environment very recently? Why don't we have a delayed present? Why don't we focus on information we gathered 10 seconds ago? Why don't we have two presents? Why don't we focus on information we gathered 10 seconds ago and 20 20 seconds ago. Well, the physicist Jim Hartle in California, who works with Hawking, thinks there is no explanation in physics at all, and the explanation must be biological. He thinks that very early on in the evolution of life on Earth, there may have been organisms that experienced time in different ways to us. There may well have been organisms that had delayed presence, or two presence, or three presence, or whatever. But imagine a tree frog that has a delayed present, that gathers information from its environment, from 10 seconds ago. So it sees a fly on a leaf, it sticks its tongue out, but by the time its tongue reaches the leaf, the fly has flown away because the frog is using outdated information. That poor frog will eventually starve to death. So Hartle's idea is that we experience time the way we do. We experience a present, all of us, because that is the best way for our survival. Now, the person who made the most insightful, the most profound and wise statement on this was President George W. Bush. He said, "I think we can all agree the past is over." Which is genius, isn't it? It's absolute genius. Okay, my next bonkers thing is when you look through a window, the most shocking discovery in the history of science is literally staring you in the face. This is actually a picture of me in Hyde Park in London. Very cold day it was. Not as cold as here, but it was very, very cold. When you look through a window, if you're looking through a window at the street outside, you see people walking their dogs maybe, cars going by. But you also see a faint reflection of your face. And the reason for that is that glass is not 100% transmitting. Maybe 95% of the light goes straight through the glass, and maybe 5% gets reflected back from the surface, which is why you see the faint reflection of your face. Now, this was very easy to understand until the early 20th century. Then many experiments revealed that light was a stream of bullet-like particles called photons. Okay, so a light beam was just like a machine gun stream of these tiny photons, all identical. Okay, the problem now is how can you possibly explain seeing your face in a window pane if light is a stream of identical photons? Because if they're all identical, then they should all be affected identically. They should either all go through the window or they should be all reflected. There is no way that you can explain how 95% go through and 5% come back, unless you change your definition of identical. And that's what physicists in the early 20th century were forced to do. They had to accept that identical meant having the same chance or probability of doing something. So photons all have a 95% chance of going through a window pane and a 5% chance of being reflected. But what this means is that if you were to follow an individual photon to the window pane, you could not tell for sure whether it would go through the window or be reflected. Okay, then this is catastrophic for physics, because all physics that had gone before, what we call classical physics, was effectively a recipe for predicting the future. If we know where the moon is today, we can calculate where it will be the same time tomorrow using Newton's law of gravity with 100% certainty. But what the photon was telling us was that we can't tell with certainty at all what it will do. And it's not just photons. It's all the microscopic building blocks of the world, the atoms and electrons. We can't tell what they will do with complete certainty. And this was so shocking to Einstein that he famously said, "God does not play dice with the universe." Only, of course, he was wrong. God does play dice with the universe. So you might wonder, if the universe is fundamentally unpredictable, how is it that it appears to be so predictable to us? I mean, how is it that we know that the sun will rise tomorrow? How is it that you knew that I would be giving this talk at this particular time tonight? Well, it turns out that what nature takes away with one hand, it grudgingly gives back with the other. So although the universe is fundamentally unpredictable, it turns out that the unpredictability is predictable. And that's quantum theory. Quantum theory is a recipe for predicting the unpredictability of things, for predicting that photons will have a 95% chance of going through a window pane or a 5% chance of being reflected. Now, this is an interesting, this is an odd bonkers thing, there is a storm at Saturn's North Pole, the shape of a hexagon. Now, on Earth, air in the atmosphere circulates in a circle. I mean, we never see a triangular hurricane or a square hurricane or a pentagonal hurricane, but here on Saturn, there is a hexagonal hurricane, and it's about twice the size of the Earth. And we know it's persistent because this image was taken, I think it's a heat image, was taken by the Cassini space probe, which is currently in orbit around Saturn. But we know that this hexagon was there in 25 years ago because the Voyager space probes, when they went past, or at least one of them went past, it saw that hexagon. So it's very, very persistent. Now, nobody really knows why it's there. It actually turns as a hexagon in, I think, about 9-10 hours, something like that. But there are clues, because when people spin fluids in buckets, they find they do get these weird kind of structures. You can get what we call standing waves, wave patterns. You can get triangular waves and square waves and all this kind of stuff. But it's believed that the waves that appear in fluids rotating in buckets are caused by the interaction between the fluid and the container. But where is the container on Saturn? You know, there is no container in the atmosphere. So, you know, on the one hand, it appears to be making patterns like we get in a rotating bucket. But on the other hand, there are differences. So it's a huge mystery. My next bonkers thing is that 1% of the static that you see on a television tuned between the channels comes from the Big Bang, from the fireball of the Big Bang. Now, the fireball of the Big Bang was like the fireball of a nuclear explosion. If you imagine a nuclear explosion in the atmosphere, fortunately we haven't had them since the early 60s, but if you imagine that you've seen the explosion, if you were to be there or look at it a day later, a week later, a year later, the heat, the light would have dissipated into the environment and it would have gone. But the fireball of the Big Bang had absolutely nowhere to go. It was bottled up in the universe, which by definition is all there is. So the heat of the Big Bang is still around us today, greatly cooled by the expansion of the universe in the last 13.7 billion years. So instead of being visible light, it's actually in the form of radio waves, with a wavelength of about a millimeter. That's where it peaks, or even microwaves, a few centimeters. And your television aerial picks up that kind of light. So if the Big Bang radiation picks up by your television aerial, before it was intercepted by your television aerial, had been traveling for 13.7 billion years across space, and the last thing it touched was the fireball of the Big Bang. Now, it turns out that this afterglow of the Big Bang accounts for 99.9% of all the photons, that's all the particles of light in the universe. Only 0.1% is tied up in the light which comes from stars and galaxies. So it is overwhelmingly the most striking feature of our universe. And if you could come out, if you had, instead of seeing with visible light, you had some kind of magic microwave glasses, and you went out in space and you looked everywhere, you would see, with these glasses that detected microwaves, you would see the entire universe glowing with this afterglow of the Big Bang. It'd be like being inside a light bulb. But ironically, this was not discovered, this afterglow of the Big Bang, until the mid-60s. And many of you probably know the story that the scientist who discovered it at Bell Labs in New Jersey, and then got the Nobel Prize, famously thought they were picking up the heat glow of pigeon droppings. Rarely in the history of science can so profound a discovery have been mistaken for something so mundane. My next bonkers thing about the universe is that you could fit the information for a million universes on a single 1 gigabit flash drive. I think I've got one in my pocket, yeah. There, I've got one on my key ring. So you could fit the information for 1 million universes on my 1 gigabit key ring flash drive. This needs a bit of explanation. The universe is expanding in the aftermath of the Big Bang. The galaxies are flying apart from each other like pieces of cosmic shrapnel. We can imagine this expansion running backwards, like a movie in reverse, so with the universe getting smaller and smaller and smaller. But the universe is quantum. Okay, now quantum doesn't just mean unpredictable. Quantum means that everything comes in indivisible tiny chunks. So there is a small, whether it's matter, whether it's energy, whatever, there's a smallest indivisible chunk that cannot be cut in half. This means that if we were to look at space with some kind of super microscope, we would see it kind of made up of tiny little indivisible chunks. So imagine, we can't imagine three dimensions. Let's imagine that the space of the universe is like a chessboard. If we imagine the universe shrinking back down to the Big Bang, we cannot shrink the chessboard because the squares can't get any smaller. So we see less and less of the chessboard. Okay? That means that there's less and less stuff that we can put in the universe. Now, we believe that the universe began in a phenomenally fast period of expansion known as inflation. And before inflation started, inflation really mushroomed the size of the universe. So the universe before inflation, in the very beginning, was very, very tiny. And it may have actually contained only about 1,000 squares of space. So only 1,000 places where you could either put energy or not have energy. Now, to describe that arrangement, you would need 1,000 bits, 1,000 binary bits. So that is why you can actually, my flash drive on my flash memory on my keyring contains a gigabit, a billion bits. That's why you could put the information for the initial state of a million universes on that keyring. So you may be asking, you may wonder, if the universe started off with so hardly any information, where did all the information around us come today? I mean, to describe our universe, you would have to describe the location of every star, every planet, its composition, you know, your where you're sitting in this lecture theatre, what you're made of. An incredible amount of information is required to describe you, to describe the current universe. So where did it all come from? Well, the answer is quantum theory. I talked about the unpredictability of photons and other microscopic particles. What they do is completely random. Now, randomness is pretty similar to information. If I were to give you a number and I said it was a billion ones, that would be a very non-random number, but it contains virtually no information because I've just told you it's 1 billion ones and you know that number completely. But if that number were completely random, so it was a billion digits and each digit was unrelated to the previous one, I'd have to tell you the whole billion digits. So the random string of digits contains a vast amount of information. So randomness is the same as information. So what's actually happened since the Big Bang is every time there's been a quantum event, Every time a photon has had the chance of being transmitted or reflected, every time an atom or nucleus could disintegrate or not disintegrate, it's done it randomly, and that's injected randomness into the universe. So that's where all the information in the universe comes from. So as I said, ironically, Einstein famously said, God does not play dice with the universe. But the irony is that if God did not play dice with the universe, there would be no universe, certainly not of the complexity to have given rise to us, intelligent life like us. My next bonkers thing about the universe is that 98% of the universe is invisible. Okay, about 4% of the universe is made of atoms, the kind of stuff that you and me are made of, that the stars are made of, that the galaxies are made of. But only about half of that have we actually directly seen with our telescopes. We think that the other half is in some kind of invisible form. It could be very cold gas between the galaxies, or it could be very hot gas, both of which might be very difficult to spot. So only 2% of the mass energy of the universe have we actually seen. But 4% we think is ordinary material or atoms. In addition to this 4%, we think that about 23% of the mass energy of the universe is made of dark matter. Okay, so that's maybe six times as much dark material as ordinary material. Now this dark material is either completely dark, so it doesn't give out any light, or it certainly gives out so little light that we can't yet detect it with our current techniques. How do we know it exists? Well, we see its gravitational effect on the visible stuff. So if we look at the stars and galaxies, we see them clustered and moving in different ways to the way they would have done if the dark matter wasn't there, because the dark matter is exerting a gravitational pull on them. So it's very much like, if you go back to the 19th century, the planet Uranus, well, actually, that was discovered in about 1781. Oddly enough, Uranus was discovered in Bath, where I was only about 3 days ago giving a talk. But anyway, discovered in about 1781, Bath. By the mid-19th century, it was noticed that it wasn't orbiting the sun in the way it should. Something was perturbing it. And people calculated that there was probably another planet further away from the sun than Uranus, which was tugging on Uranus. And relatively quickly, people found the planet Neptune. So Neptune, in a way, was the dark matter of its day. Now, what is the dark matter made of? Well, no one really knows, but a physicist's prejudice is probably that it's made of some kind of subatomic particle that we haven't yet discovered. Mainly because many of the speculative theories of particle physics do contain a lot of particles to which we haven't yet discovered. So it could be made of some kind of unknown subatomic particle. Now, in addition to the 4% ordinary material in the universe and the 23% dark matter, a whopping 73% is what we call dark energy. Now, dark energy fills all of space, it's invisible, and it has repulsive gravity. So it kind of blows rather than sucks. So ironically, when you were at school, you probably learned that Newton's law of gravity tells us that things attract each other with gravity. But ironically, most of the stuff in the universe is actually repelling itself with gravity. And when we come to dark energy, physicists are really pretty much at sea at explaining it. If we use quantum theory, quantum theory is fantastically successful. You know, it's given us lasers and nuclear reactors and computers. It explains why the sun shines, why this stage is solid under my feet. But when you use quantum theory to predict the energy density of empty space, the vacuum, the dark energy, you get a number which is 1 followed by 120 zeros bigger than what we observe. That is the biggest discrepancy between a prediction and an observation in the history of science. So could be that there's a big idea missing there. Now I come to my number one bonkers thing about the universe is that out in the universe are an infinite number of copies of you listening to an infinite number of copies of me banging on about my top 10 bonkers things about the universe. Now this takes a bit of explanation as well. Basically, the thing you need to know is that the universe was born. It hasn't existed forever, but it was born. We think it was born about 13.7 billion years ago. And what this means is that we can only see the objects in the universe, the stars and galaxies, whose light has taken less than 13.7 billion years to get here. Objects whose light would take 14.7 billion years to get here, well, their light is still on its way. It won't get here for another billion years. So because of this, we only see a portion of the universe. We call it the observable universe, and it contains something like about 100 billion galaxies like our own Milky Way. And bounding this observable universe, I mean, you can imagine it's like a bubble. The surface of the bubble we call the horizon, the light horizon. So beyond the horizon, there is more of the universe. The question is, how much of the universe is there beyond the light horizon? Well, according to inflation, effectively, there may be an infinite amount of universe beyond the horizon. So what's it like? So if you can imagine, there's our universe, which is kind of 100 billion galaxies in a little bubble, and beyond our bubble, there are an infinite number of other bubbles. What's it like in all those bubbles? Well, they had big bangs just like ours. I mean, they had a portion of our big bang, and out of the cooling debris of their big bangs, they formed galaxies and stars, different galaxies and stars. So the universe, these universes had slightly different histories to ours. Okay, but it turns out there's another thing that you need to know, and that is that the universe is quantum once again. And this means that as we go back to the Big Bang, as I said before, space is like a chessboard. And just as there are only a finite number of ways that you can actually arrange the pieces on a chessboard, there are only a finite number of ways that in the beginning of the universe you could arrange the matter of the universe. Okay, and that arrangement of matter, the matter that you arrange, the seeds of galaxies. So as the universe grows older, these original seeds gather about the more matter and they make galaxies. So the quantumness of the universe tells us that there are only a finite number of possible arrangements of the seeds of galaxies in the beginning, which means there are only a finite number of possible histories. So we have a finite number of possible histories for the universe, but an infinite number of places where those histories can be played out. So that means that every history happens not just once, but an infinite number of times. So not only there are an infinite number of places in the universe where none of you came to this lecture tonight. You know, if there was something better on television and you didn't come. There are an infinite number of places where President Mubarak is still president of Egypt and is looking forward to the next 10 years in power. There are an infinite number of places where the dinosaurs were not wiped out by an asteroid 65 million years ago, but went on to invent the motor car. Why is this my number one bonkers thing about the universe? Well, even if this is the worst, dullest, most boring talk you've ever been to, I can console myself that in an infinite number of other universes, you gave me a standing ovation and thought this was the best talk you've ever been to. Thank you very much.
So now it is time for some questions. We do have two microphones in the aisles. Raise your hand and we'll bring the microphone to you.
The neutrino picture of the sun, was that collected over time? And if so, how much time did it take to accumulate that?
Yeah, it's not an instantaneous picture of the sun. You're absolutely right. When I said there were 100 million million neutrinos going through my thumb every second, that isn't a picture of the sun taken, you know, as a snapshot in a second. I'm not quite sure how long it took, but I'm sure it might have taken many months to take that picture. But it, you know, to my mind, it's an absolutely incredible picture. You know, the sun taken at night. To me, it ranks with, you know, a picture of the DNA spiral, or even the Earth rising above the moon. You know, it's just one of those fantastic shots.
I am totally fascinated by the thought that somewhere in the universe there may be a sun made out of bananas. I looked up bananas on the internet and I find that a banana is made of about 75% water and about 25% carbohydrate, which means that the number of hydrogen atoms in a banana is pretty high. Is there enough there to sustain a nuclear fusion reaction?
No, not at all. But that's why I was very careful about dividing that thing into two. I was telling you why the sun is hot at this instant, which is entirely because, well, pretty much because of its mass. And then I divided it into then why does it stay hot? Well, as you point out, if it was made of bananas, it wouldn't actually have the hydrogen, the amount of hydrogen that the sun's got. Yeah.
Where are we? Right here, on the way.
Hi, my question is about the example you gave about the time machine with the wormhole.
So time machine in the wormhole, yes.
So instead of using wormhole, say I'm given to understand for a quantum system, in theory you can split the system as far apart as possible, and if you observe one part of it, the whole system collapses to manifest a result. So say that we spread this system, one at, say, Earth, and the other one at the event horizon of the black hole, and we observe it at the Earth. So would you say that the system will collapse in the present or in the future? And do you think that this is classified as intertemporal transmission of information?
Right, I think that's a very good question. And I can't actually even think of the answer on the spot, but I'd be happy to talk to you about it afterwards.
Excellent question.
Regarding the emptiness of the atom or within the structure of all matter, might it not be that emptiness probably is full of yet subatomic particles yet to be discovered?
It's conceivable, but probably not very likely. I mean, certainly when we talk about, I was telling you that dark matter is maybe six times as common as normal matter, then it's clearly in this room. But it doesn't interact with normal matter, and so it doesn't affect us. So, you know, whether some of those dark matter particles are actually inside atoms, probably unlikely, but they might be passing through. So, yeah, it's a good point, yeah.
For quite a few years, I've had arguments with a number of people about the concept of destiny and fate. And with what I understood about quantum physics, there couldn't be such a thing because everything is based on randomness. But what you just said about there being initially a very, very small number of a very small initial state for the universe prior to inflation. You might say then that there is a fate for everything. It's just that you just don't know where it is in the entire multiverse, universe, whatever you want to call it. So my question is really, locally, could we say that there's any possibility of foretelling the future based on the fact that we can't get to these other places. And therefore, the idea of fate and destiny are toast here in a practical term, if not maybe for real in the multiverse.
I mean, certainly, free will was a problem within classical physics because it did appear that the universe was running like a machine. And if you knew the initial conditions, you know the laws of physics, so you can extrapolate the future. And that was a real problem because it did look as if, there was no free will. We don't really know whether quantum theory solves that problem, but it certainly does introduce unpredictability. That's really about all I can say on that matter. Thank you.
We'll take two more questions.
Like an atom, a neutron has internal structure. Is there a way to describe the emptiness inside the neutron or estimate how much emptiness there is there?
The problem you've got there is that I think the quarks are pretty much point-like. So I don't quite know how you do that. But yeah, inside the nucleus. One of the interesting things about the quarks is that they actually contain very little mass. So I think they account for something like 1% of the mass of a nucleon, like a proton or a neutron. So it's very interesting that you hear that the Large Hadron Collider, if it finds the Higgs particle, will actually find the origin of mass. Well, in fact, it will only find the origin of 1% of the mass. So, interestingly, your question's interesting because atoms, as you say, atoms are incredibly empty, but then the neutrons and protons are probably very empty as well. So, yeah, we are pretty much ghost-like. I mean, it doesn't seem like it, but we're pretty much like ghosts.
If you could make the moon disappear instantly, would the gravitational effect of the moon on Earth disappear instantly?
Well, the answer is no. I mean, we as far as we know, the gravitational field, the effect of gravity moves at the speed of light, as far as we know. So the light takes about a quarter of a second to come from the moon to the Earth. So yeah, the gravitational effect would vanish a quarter of a second later. And with the sun, if the sun were removed, we the Earth would continue orbiting the sun for another 8.5 minutes before it suddenly realized the sun had gone. And then it would fly off at a tangent. So that's the major difference between, one of the differences between Newton's picture of gravity and Einstein's. Because Newton thought that the gravitational force was instantaneous, so it was effectively infinitely fast, and the Earth would feel it, instantly. But Einstein taught us that there would be a delay.
Let's take one more question at the back.
Yes, thanks. I've always found this puzzling, and that's if an astronaut were to leave the Earth at close to the speed of light, and we were able to observe him, we would see that time has slowed down for him. Is it fair to say then that if he were to look back at Earth, he would see everything sped up? And if so, why is there a lack of symmetry?
Well, no, you'd see they would look back and see the Earth slowed down as well, because that's the magic of relativity, that it's there is no such thing as absolute motion. So if you're moving relative to someone at nearly the speed of light, they're moving relative to you at nearly the speed of light. So both of you see things slow down. That's the magic of relativity. It's amazing.
Thank you again, Marcus.
Thank you. Thanks.